It's Friday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Turkey and Russia trade accusations over a downed fighter jet.
They've been playing on fear in order to try to score political points or to advance their campaigns.
A political fight rages over Syrian refugees in the United States. Also ahead, our third and final installment of Traveling Inside North Korea. Twyla Tharp dances to a golden anniversary. It's all on today's International Edition. As French President François Hollande continues his global diplomatic effort to forge an alliance against the Islamic State group with a stop in Moscow Thursday, tensions between Russia and Turkey over the downing of a Russian warplane remain high. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told a news conference in Russia that that country does not intend to wage war on Turkey, but said the incident looked very much like a pre-planned operation and promised a reassessment of bilateral relations. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called it a purely defensive move and not designed to escalate matters. Moscow has announced plans to deploy an air defense missile system in northwestern Syria to protect its aircraft. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was posted to Ankara and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says it was a calculated move by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's probably the least Putin could do, and it represents not a good thing because it will threaten the Israelis, and the thing has a range of 155 miles, potentially also some of our aircraft if they were foolish enough to shoot at us. It's essentially a defensive step, and it's better than bombing a Turkish airfield.
Was that a possibility in your view?
Here's the thing. We have learned since 1999, with Putin's having a major role in Russian battalions showing up in Kosovo after we had defeated the Serbs, that you don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you. And he's a guy who basically takes risks all the time with the assumption, which he has been proven correct again and again and again, with all of the NATO allies and all kinds of overflights of NATO territory, all sorts of provocations, his submarines in national waters, what he's done in Crimea, what he did in the Ukraine. And he's done this repeatedly with the Turks, particularly back in October. He not only penetrated Turkish airspace, but they locked on Turkish aircraft with their fire control radars. And they've been warned repeatedly by the Turks on this, and the Turks also warned them about bombing the Turkmen right along the border. I think he was surprised by what Erdogan did.
Is this going to suck the NATO alliance and Russia into some sort of confrontation?
I don't see how. If Russia takes military action against Turkey, yes, obviously, but Russia hasn't taken military action against Turkey. And NATO already has surface-to-air missiles in southern Turkey. We just withdrew them, but they can go back in. We have a relatively large contingent of aircraft at Incirlik and elsewhere in southern Turkey. And the Turks have a fleet of 200-plus F-16s. To put that in context, Putin has, he had 30 aircraft, roughly. Now he's got 29.
Ambassador Jeffrey also feels that Russia has little leverage with Turkey, given its membership in NATO and also control of key shipping lanes that Russia uses. Well, it's time now to check out what's buzzing online. It's still Thursday here in the United States, and we're enjoying some good Thanksgiving food. As always, our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is here in the studio with the trending stories. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Let's begin with what many people consider to be the most important element of this holiday, the food. Millions of Americans are gathered today to enjoy turkey, stuffing, and all sorts of spreads, but two Americans are preparing for a slightly different fare. They are NASA astronauts Terry Virts and Barry Wilmore, who are almost 300 miles above the Earth.
I imagine they're not trying to stuff a turkey in zero gravity. What are these guys having?
The answer is in the YouTube video NASA posted. The two American astronauts, with the help of their four colleagues on the International Space Station, put together some of the core items they already have on hand aboard the ISS. So that came out to be turkey exposed to radiation. Yummy. Candied yams and freeze-dried cornbread dressing. To top it off, the dessert was made with cranberry and apple. Now, Jim, from the video, it looks like they have sriracha on hand.
Well, that's great. They can spice some things up if they wanted to. Explain about the sauce, though, because I'm sure many of our viewers are not familiar with it.
Sure, it's a very popular condiment originating from Thailand. It's now made in California, created by a Vietnamese-American named David Tran. It's spicy and a bit more watery than ketchup, and other companies came up with their own versions of this sauce. And the word sriracha is now considered a generic term by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Well, before you go, tell us one other story that's trending.
Okay, so this is not very much in line with the Thanksgiving spirit, but it is making headlines. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump was mocking a New York Times reporter at a rally in South Carolina, and the reporter apparently has a joint condition that affects his movement. Trump was imitating the reporter, moving his arms every which way as he does, and what's really disturbing is that the people at the rally are seen laughing at his comical gestures, mocking at a physically challenged person. Jim, we have been talking a lot about the billionaire contender in recent months, but maybe after this incident, we might hear a little less about him. Back to you.
Well, we'll see. Thanks for being here, G, and follow those trends for us. She also tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA _IE, and you can follow her on her own account at G Abby Lee. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. As the U.S. Congress considers suspending a program allowing Syrian refugees into the country, those already here or in the asylum process are alarmed by what they're hearing. VOA's Jeff Swikert introduces us to one such family that worries that the current debate over Syrian refugees may further delay their application process.
Tafiq al-Halak and his wife Zarek al-Sosa arrived in the U.S. on a tourist visa in July 2012. A well-known TV journalist in Syria, Tafiq began to write on Facebook about the country's mounting revolt against the government and soon got an unexpected visitor from the Assad regime.
He said, "Either you stop writing or I will kill you, burn down your house and kill your family." I asked if he knew who I was. "I know you are Tafiq al-Halak, the famous TV presenter. Even if you are God, I will kill you and your family."
After stops in Tunisia and then Egypt, where he received another death threat, Tafiq and his wife arrived in the U.S. and applied for political asylum. The United States has a long history of opening its doors to refugees from around the world. After authorities said one of the recent Paris attackers entered Europe as a refugee, Republican presidential candidates in the U.S. started calling for tighter restrictions on Syrian refugees. Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz.
"I am leading the fight in the U.S. Senate to stop President Obama and Hillary Clinton's plan to bring to America tens of thousands of Syrian Muslim refugees. Why? Because the administration itself admits it cannot vet these refugees."
Republican frontrunner Donald Trump called for more tracking of refugees in the U.S.
"But database is okay, and watch list is okay, and surveillance is okay. If you don't mind, I want surveillance of these people that are coming in, the Trojan horse."
President Obama, while on a trip to Asia, disagreed.
They've been playing on fear in order to try to score political points or to advance their campaigns. And it's irresponsible.
But Republican leaders on Capitol Hill, with some Democratic votes, passed a bill to halt Syrian refugees from entering the country. Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan.
If our law enforcement and intelligence community cannot verify that each and every person coming here is not a security threat, then they shouldn't be allowed in.
The legislation awaits a vote in the Senate within the next few weeks. President Obama has vowed to veto it. Still, Al-Halak worries that the rhetoric around Syrians could affect even those already in the U.S. His family's status is still undecided. The only thing certain in their lives is that they cannot go back to Syria. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Washington.
The two Koreas agreed Thursday to hold a rare high-level dialogue next month, in line with an accord struck in August aimed at easing cross-border tensions, the Unification Ministry in Seoul announced. A ministry spokesman said the two sides would be meeting at the deputy minister level on December 11th. Major issues between the nations include reunions for surviving members of families separated decades ago by the division of the Korean Peninsula and lifting of Seoul's punitive sanctions on the north. Today we hear the third and final part of our discussion about North Korea with Christian Peterson Clausen, a German-born photographer for NKNews.org, talks about the control of information compared to the former East Germany and what tourists might expect when they take photos in North Korea.
We shouldn't make light of things like the Stasi, and that took a lot of power away in East Germany. I think in North Korea, they're still on a whole other level as far as fear and powerlessness are considered. The North Koreans are extremely intense on it, and you see it even when you go over there and just talk to the guides who are showing you the country. Basically, what happens if you're a tourist and you go to North Korea is there's a Western tour company. They bring you over, but in North Korea, you have a North Korean bus driver and two tour guides who were very, very nice people. But it was made very clear up front to us that if we do anything that the North Korean government wouldn't like, we wouldn't be in trouble. They would be. If, for instance, I happen to take a picture of a farmer with an ox-drawn cart, which is something the government doesn't like because they don't want to see photos on the internet that could be used to make fun of their poverty or make fun of North Korea, then the guides would really start sweating bullets. And one of the big things also was, you know, please don't photograph a checkpoint or don't photograph soldiers. If they saw my camera out there, they would be practically begging me not to get them into trouble. And those were moments where I could really tell that they were scared. They were really, really scared of what would happen to them if I was, you know, not as nice as I ended up being to them.
It's almost human nature. If you see, for instance, a sign that says wet paint, you're almost compelled to touch it. I would guess as a tourist, if somebody tells you you can't photograph something, you almost want to try to get a picture of it.
Of course, but, you know, I mean, for me, it's the interesting thing. It's the same thing, like you said, from all the construction sites are the most interesting places for children to go to, and yet they're the places they're not supposed to go to, right? Here it was, I see a lady selling her little goods on the side of the road. Of course, I'm interested in that. And you know, it's something that I would like to photograph. Or I've noticed that there were a lot of young soldiers who were just marching all over the country. And that's interesting to me. And I wanted to show what their life is like. Or in the countryside where buses are often little tractors with a trailer behind it or something very rickety old. That would be interesting because it's different from what we perhaps see to document. But oftentimes these were things that made the North Koreans very nervous. And I think it has to do a lot with pride. They are aware of how little they have now. They are aware that they're not being admired abroad for the situation right now. They are a bit touchy when it comes to that.
So as a tourist, as you're taking photos in the places that you're visiting, what sort of pictures do you end up with?
If you took pictures of the statues, gigantic statues, often bronze, of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung are everywhere. they would love it if you just documented the museums. And North Korea is a country filled with museums that all center about those two leaders. There's one painting where you see American soldiers and priests together putting stones around the necks of North Korean women and throwing them off a bridge in a river. That is the kind of stuff that the North Koreans would like you to photograph. They would like you to see all that and accept their point of view.
Christian Peterson Clausen, who had his points of view as he traveled throughout North Korea, and you may see many of his photos at nknews.org. They're also featured in their 2016 calendar. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp is an American legend, an icon. She's celebrating her 50th anniversary in the world of dance this year. She's won a Tony, two Emmys, and has been to the Kennedy Center as an honoree. For her golden anniversary this year, Tharp has been taking a pair of new works on a 17-city tour. Bill Zeebel reports from Dallas, Texas, where the tour began.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
In April of 1965, Twyla Tharp, with two colleagues, danced her first work using Petula Clark's popular song, Downtown.
Just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose?
She told the Dallas audience that Tank Dive premiered in New York's Hunter College and lasted all of about 4.5 minutes.
Because I figured that's all I knew about a beginning and a middle and an end, and I could get it into that period of time. So if you were late, you kind of missed the whole thing. But that was okay because I think 14 people came. And that's okay too.
Because she knew that she could do it. She's since created hundreds of dances over 5 decades, presenting them on the dance stage, Broadway theaters, for television and film. On this anniversary tour, she presents not one, but two premieres. Tharp is 74. She does not believe in slowing down.
The point of work is, to me, doing more work. There's always time for the past, and I value the past. Not only my past, but others' past. But the future's got lots of room for the past. The present has only now.
And for now, Tharp says it's time for the world as it ought to be and for the world as it is, at least according to her. To Bach's well-tempered clavier, Tharp pays tribute to dance giants she learned from, Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, Jerome Robbins, George Balanchine. Tharp's first work, Preludes and Fugues, presents a world of equality, justice, balance.
People have an overview of tolerance, and that diversity does not separate. It is possible to congregate as a diverse lot. That would be the world as it ought to be. The world as it is had best be approached with humor.
And so the other work, Yaozi, is danced to jazz with funny interactions between couples and slapstick moves inspired by Tharp's beloved silent film comedies. As she helped pioneer the use of pop, rock, and jazz in serious dance, Tharp also blended modern and classical ballet moves in her work. That used to shock the dance world, but no more. Dancer John Celia, who matured with the Classical American Ballet Theater, joined Tharp 16 years ago.
I love being a ballet dancer, but sometimes I disagree with how marginalized it is. People have a certain idea of it, and if it goes out of the boundaries, they reject it.
Celia embraced it, welcoming the challenge of dancing in Tharp's company and learning to be more creative than he'd been allowed at ABT. Combining dance styles and musical genres opened up the art form, says Lily Weiss. The longtime professional dancer is the artistic director at Dallas's Booker T. Washington High School. It's consistently among the nation's best art schools. She says Tharp, the pioneer, is the role model for pushing boundaries.
That's why she was so accessible and so successful, I think, is she not only spoke to the patron who wants to be moved by art, but she spoke to a patron that enjoyed watching accessible dance.
Tharp is also just really funny. She was a pre-med student before deciding she could learn more about the human body through dance. Other than honorary degrees, she doesn't have a PhD or medical degree, but she says she's a doctor of sorts and pounds the microphone for emphasis.
I do consider myself a doctor, and one of my missions is that when an audience leaves our theater, that audience needs to feel better leaving than it did coming in. And if it doesn't, we haven't done our job.
Twyla Tharp's anniversary prescription to audiences has been these two new works and two past pieces on a triumphant national tour. For VOA News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website at voanews.com. And we're also on Twitter. Our handle at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Zinam Abdel-Rahman. And I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a great weekend. Come back and visit with us again.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hard on the heels of the terrorist attack in Paris, which resulted in the deaths of some 130 people, came a terrorist attack on a hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali. Prior to 2012, Mali was one of Africa's longest established democracies, but a failure to deal with ethnic tensions in the north, as well as the presence of extremist groups operating from safe havens in the north, led to a Tuareg rebellion. This rebellion was then usurped by violent extremist elements, reinforced with arms and fighters from Libya. The country was destabilized, and this led to a military coup in 2012. Extremists with links to Al-Qaeda occupied large parts of northern Mali and began to institute their fundamentalist version of Sharia and brutalize the civilian population, forcing thousands to flee. The Malian government requested help. In 2012, a French military force backed by African partners from Chad and Niger under Operation Sabre disrupted and scattered extremist forces, which largely fled to Tunisia and Libya. However, remnants of the extremist group continue asymmetric attacks against the Malian government as well as the United Nations peacekeeping mission. The French continue counterterrorism operations against extremists. There is good reason to believe that terrorists chose their target specifically because the hotel is popular with foreigners, and at the time of the attack was hosting a number of delegations attending peace talks. At least 22 people died, among them 6 Russians, 3 Chinese nationals, an Israeli, an American, 2 Belgians, 1 citizen of Senegal, and another from Lebanon. Many of the victims, including one American, were people who came to Bamako to help the Malian government and the Malian people through difficult times. These international efforts to restore peace, security, and prosperity in Mali will continue. The support of the U.S. government in these efforts will continue as well. The United States condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist attacks in Bamako. We extend our deep condolences to the families and loved ones of those who have been killed in this heinous attack, said U.S. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price. The United States stands with the people of Mali and will remain a steadfast partner along with other key allies and African partners fighting the terrorist groups that seek to undermine Mali's efforts to build durable peace and stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.